This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. 8 out of 10 of every Americans, or 80% of us, live in metropolitan counties, that is, in major cities and their suburbs. And those Americans went to the polls this week to choose their next municipal leaders, mayors, district attorneys, city council members, school board members. While there's a lot of focus right now on gubernatorial outcomes, particularly in the state of Virginia, the municipal races might actually reveal more, because again, that's where 8 out of 10 Americans actually live. So that's what we'll do today. We'll look at city elections in Minnesota, Washington State, Florida, New Mexico, New York. And we'll begin with a brief stop in Dearborn, Michigan, the Detroit suburb and home to Ford Motor Company's world headquarters. Stephen Henderson, a host at Detroit's NPR station WDET, said that when he was growing up in Detroit, he knew Dearborn as a mostly white city with an openly racist mayor, Orville Hubbard. Hubbard was Dearborn's longest-serving mayor, in the post from 1942 to 1978. But the city has been significantly changing. Last year, a statue of Hubbard was removed from outside the Dearborn Historical Museum, and Arab Americans make up a significant portion of Dearborn's modern population. And this week, the city elected its first Arab American mayor, Abdullah Hamoud. And Stephen Henderson says it's an inflection point in Dearborn's history.
He was not shy about tying his candidacy to the demographic change of the city and telling everybody that, you know, it was going to be okay, that they wanted to govern together. He wants to govern in an inclusive way, but it's important that this demographic change, the people who are part of that demographic change are going to have a voice in city government that they never had before. And he got some pushback about that. I mean, there were people who were uncomfortable with some of the language he used around that, but it certainly never was explicitly exclusionary. He really, I thought, did a good job of saying we want to work together. We want to build a coalition that will lead Dearborn, and we haven't had that before. I mean, it has been exclusionary of this population.
That's Stephen Henderson, host at WDET in Detroit, talking about Dearborn, Michigan's first ever Arab-American mayor, newly elected Abdullah Hamoud. Well, joining us now is Anthony Brooks, senior political correspondent for our home station, WBUR, here in Boston, and of course, a frequent fill-in host right here at On Point. Hello there, Anthony.
Hi, Meghna. Nice to be with you.
So we have to talk about a similar sort of seismic change, like Stephen was talking about in Dearborn, that happened here in Boston. So let's just listen to a second from the city's newly elected mayor, Michelle Wu. Here she is on election night.
So one of my sons asked me the other night if boys can be elected mayor in Boston. Someday, but not tonight.
So, Anthony, the Boston mayoral race was actually a closely watched one nationwide. What is the significance of Michelle Wu's win on Tuesday night?
Yeah, well, that was a great moment in her victory speech Tuesday night. So Michelle Wu is the first. Look, for 200 years, Boston has elected only white men until this past Tuesday when Michelle Wu, a 36-year-old daughter of Taiwanese immigrants, was elected. She becomes the first Asian American, the first woman, the first person of color to lead this city in 200 years of electing mayors. Significant as well. I mean, there are a lot of stories about Michelle Wu's victory here. It's important for Boston, which has a long, troubled history around race and politics of exclusion. Wu ran a campaign of inclusion and won the support of a broad coalition across the city, white progressives, blacks, Asians, Latino voters, and really reflected, like we heard there in Dearborn, Michigan, the city's changing demographics, younger, more diverse, a growing immigrant population. And she ran on an unapologetically progressive agenda, following things like offering things like free public transportation, a Green New Deal for the city of Boston, which isn't just about planting more trees. It's about addressing generations of economic inequality. So this is a major transition for Boston, and according to lots of people in the city, overdue.
And, you know, Boston had a really vigorous, interesting race that no matter who would have won, because now I guess Mayor-elect Wu's competitor, Anissa Asabi George, also had, you know, a wonderfully interesting background that reflected the sort of Boston as it is now, as a majority city of people of color, you know, young, leaning definitely left, leftward. Talk a little bit about that.
Yeah, really interesting. So she ran against and defeated city councilor, fellow city councilor, Anissa Asabi George. Asabi George was the daughter of a Polish immigrant mother and an Arab American, a Tunisian dad, a Muslim. And so she also identified as a woman of color. I think in any other city, Anissa Asabi George could have claimed the mantle of a progressive. They were both Democrats. But compared to Wu, she was much more moderate. She called a lot of Wu's progressive agenda unworkable and too costly. And frankly, she was really counting on sort of support from older Boston, from an electorate that was older, that was whiter, and that was definitely politically more moderate. And she got absolutely crushed by Wu, 28 points. And Wu won everywhere. We did polling before this election, and it was borne out. Wu had the election, the backing not only of progressive segments of Boston, but, you know, she won in neighborhoods where Asabi George was expected to do well. She won a majority of white voters, of black voters, of Asian voters, of Latino voters. I mean, she just absolutely crushed Asabi George.
Well, so
and one more thing, Megha, that I would just say about this, and you put your finger on it. It was a really interesting race because it was substantive, and it really got to the core of what is the role of government. And particularly municipal government. And Asabi George had a more limited view and said, you know, mayors first and foremost have to fill potholes. Yes, we've got to improve schools. Yes, we've got to make neighborhoods safe. But Michelle Wu really went farther and said, this is a moment when city government can really come up to the table and address generations of exclusion and inequality. And that carried the day.
Well, so that's exactly what I want to just ask you one more quick question about before we move away from Boston. Because, okay, so it makes sense that a city like Boston, you know, deep blue, is where a progressive mayoral candidate, you know, would really push to the left and win. But, you know, we've seen in other American cities, we'll visit some of them over the course of this hour, where the progressive did not win. And I wonder, at what point in time will now mayor-elect Michelle Wu face the reality that, say, you know, Joe Biden is facing right now, just take it up to the national level here, that when you promise the moon, right, when you promise that transformational change and you have a hard time delivering, I mean, one of the things Wu promises bringing rent control back. I just wonder what's the prospect of things coming back down to earth rather quickly for even the most well-supported progressive mayor in the United States?
No, it's a great question. And, you know, another way to ask that question is what's the big challenge that she's going to face? And she's going to face the challenge of trying to convert a sort of aspirational campaign to the reality of governing in a city where there are still entrenched interests. Rent control is a great example. She ran on that. The state basically made rent control illegal. So she doesn't have the authority on her own to just say we're bringing rent control back. Free public transportation. It's a great idea. A lot of people love it. But again, public transportation in the city of Boston is run and funded by the state. So she can't do that on her own. A Green New Deal. It sounds fantastic and it's important in a city that is on the Atlantic Ocean and that faces the risk. But again, these are huge sweeping policies that involve federal, state, as well as municipal actors. So yeah, she's going to face real challenges. And I don't want to be pessimistic and say be brought down to earth, but she is going to have to find the way to challenge entrenched interests that have long had a lot to say about, policies at the city level.
Fine, Anthony. I'll be the string on your balloon, tugging you down. All right. So hang on here for just a second, Anthony, because you're gonna help walk us through some of these other cities that we're going to visit now. So let's turn to Minneapolis and just hear about Mayor Jacob Frey, who was elected to another term. One of the decisions Minneapolis voters had to make was about ballot question two there, whether or not to replace the police department with a new Department of Public Safety. Now, Frey opposed eliminating the police department, which many saw as a political risk he was taking.
Now, importantly, regardless of whether you are for question two, regardless of whether you voted for me or somebody else, now is the moment to come together. It's a moment to unite. It's a moment to put down the arms and take up a willingness to see true progress. And we know that true progress is going to take real work. And this is a moment of transformation in our city if we can actually come together recognizing the magnitude of this particular moment.
That's re-elected Mayor Jacob Frey in Minneapolis this week. And joining us now from Minneapolis is John Collins, senior reporter on race, class, and communities at Minnesota Public Radio. Hello there, John.
Hi, Meghna.
So we just got a minute before we crash into the first break here. Give me your first big takeaway about Frey's re-election.
Sure. I mean, it was highly tied to public safety. As you mentioned, we had a ballot initiative that would have replaced the Minneapolis Police Department with a Department of Public Safety. And George Floyd was killed here a year and a half ago, which really spurred protest. It spurred civil unrest. We had the National Guard called in. So that all happened at the same time as rising crime. So the public safety was the main issue of this election.
Okay, so John, we're going to talk with you quite a bit more on the other side of this break. So stand by. And Anthony, too, we're visiting several major American municipalities this hour to find out what happened this week in mayoral elections, district attorney elections, to get a sense as to what we can learn from America's cities about what might happen in 2022. So we'll have a lot more when we come back. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/on point. That's Indeed.com/on point. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This is On Point of Meghna Chakrabarty, and today we are visiting major American municipalities to take a look at local mayoral elections, city council elections, even district attorney races there that took place this week, to see what it tells us about the mood, the values, what people want out of American municipalities. Because again, 80% of you live in those very places. And Anthony Brooks joins us. He's senior political correspondent here at our home station of WBUR. And right now, let's pick up our conversation with Minneapolis. And John Collins is with us, senior reporter on race, class, and communities at Minnesota Public Radio. And John, you were telling us about how public safety was really front and center in the Minneapolis race here. Can you tell us a little bit more about that ballot measure, that question too about idea to reform police? I understand that it did not pass. Is that right?
Yeah, it did not pass. It failed with 44% of the vote. And it was a campaign that was spurred by the killing of George Floyd and the protests that came out of that. And so for the last few months, all over the city, the organizations for and against it and the candidates who are for and against it have been campaigning. Everyone, mailboxes have been stuffed with mailers supporting one side or another. You know, up and down the streets, there are signs, mm-hmm. especially in some neighborhoods. So there was a lot of interest.
Right. And I mean, in Minneapolis in particular, as you so rightly reminded us, this is especially important because that is where George Floyd was murdered. And and simultaneously over the past year, we've seen this major rise in the crime rate in American cities. So both deep concerns about policing and the reality of crime here. So I'm wondering, how did the advocates for that ballot measure, which failed, that ballot question failed, how did they talk about their reform efforts of policing? Did they use the language of defunding? And if not, who did?
Advocates did not. And they portrayed creating this new Department of Public Safety as an opportunity to actually make a change in policing. They said, for decades, people have tried to reform the MPD, and look, there's been no real effective change. So they said, this is our shot. But opponents argued that the advocates did not have a plan in place. And the opponents also used the rhetoric that we're now seeing used nationwide in political fights of saying that the vote would abolish police, essentially. And, you know, even Mayor Jacob Frey's campaign, you know, in order to go after his challengers, at some points called them the defund and abolish coalition. So the rhetoric that we're hearing nationwide was also happening in Minneapolis.
So to be clear, Jacob Frey, the newly reelected mayor, Democrat, was saying this.
Yeah, and he opposed the measure.
He opposed the measure. But in that sense, was he sounding more like a Republican than what one might consider a quote-unquote Democrat in Minneapolis?
Well, Minneapolis is a very Democratic city. I mean, the only candidates, serious candidates for mayor are members of the Democratic Farmer Labor Party, which is the Minnesota version of the Democratic Party. So there is some sort of divide between moderates and progressives in the city, and especially we're seeing that with younger folks. So what happened, the city council was also up for election, was two of the city council candidates who did support the ballot question, who've been outspoken about police reform in this Department of Public Safety, they lost their seats. They faced opponents who earned a lot of money and had a lot of support from more moderate and the business interests in the city. But at the same time, it's not just one message. There wasn't, you know, a wave of just pro-police voting. Minneapolis voters also elected three new young council members who were all endorsed by the Democratic Socialists of America. It's a more mixed sort of reaction. There's not really one takeaway that you can get from this, except that, you know, the people who are really inspired, the bases that were really inspired, whether it was critical of police or, you know, pro police, were really motivated in the areas where they are residents.
Yeah. You know, John, I have to just say, I really want to thank you for saying that there's not just one takeaway, because there never really is, right? this nation is too complicated to ever say what is the one takeaway. So we're seeking what the true multiple takeaways are here. And one of the things I'm seeing here, though, is that in addition, there was ranked choice voting in this election. Is that right? How did that have an impact on the outcomes, you think?
It's actually so we've had ranked choice voting in Minneapolis for quite a while, but this was the first time that we saw a very refined strategy used, and that was by two of Jacob Frey's main opponents. So progressives in the race didn't coalesce around one progressive opponent to Jacob Frey. There were two. It was Sheila Najad and former state rep Kate Knuth. And so they formed an alliance of sorts, actually, saying, okay, telling their supporters, rank me first and then rank the other person second. And progressive groups also chimed in on this. So we would see signs around the city saying, don't rank Frey, or, you know, Jacob must go, essentially saying, don't even put him on the ballot, in an effort to maybe, if they realized they weren't going to win that first round of voting, to try and pick it up in the second or third round.
Now, one more question for you, John, here. For listeners across the country who are looking at Minneapolis, what do you think is most important for them to understand in terms of, can we take any lessons from the election this week in Minneapolis and apply them nationally?
I think so. I mean, the George Floyd's murder by a Minneapolis police officer sparked a movement and a reckoning. And activists that I talked to yesterday were disappointed, but they also are saying there are many different routes that they can take to change. And they're saying that Minneapolis, the awareness, 44% of people did vote for this. And they're saying that the awareness in the city in the last year and a half led to 44% of people supporting it, which is very close to half. And they said American policing is pretty old. It's a century and a half old, and you can't expect to just turn it over in a year. So they do feel they've made some progress, and most of them say that they're going to keep on fighting, whether it's another ballot initiative or, you know, taking other means to make change in policing here.
Right. And it's fair for them to expect newly reelected Mayor Jacob Frey to not ignore that almost half of the voters who wanted that that ballot question affirmatively answered. So John Collins, senior reporter on race, class and communities at Minnesota Public Radio, with us from Minneapolis. Thank you so very much, John.
Oh, thanks for having me.
All right. So this issue of policing, Anthony, was really front and center in many of the municipal elections. So let's just stop briefly in Albuquerque, New Mexico, state's largest city, of course. And Albuquerque's incumbent mayor, Tim Keller, was elected to another term. Marisa DeMarco is the editor-in-chief of Source NM, a nonprofit newsroom in Albuquerque. And she told us that in 2012, Albuquerque's police department was the subject of a Department of Justice civil investigation. And the DOJ found that the Albuquerque PD used deadly force in, quote, an unconstitutional manner. So Marisa told us what was on the minds of voters as they went to the polls this week.
There's a history of around the country of crime being used during campaigns to pull voters in a direction of more conservative candidates. And so we saw in this election, the incumbent Tim Keller was up against the county's sheriff, who is his opponent, right? So of course it becomes a law and order focused campaign, right? But the mayor, Tim Keller, was also coming off of a summer of protests in which hundreds of people every night for weeks and weeks in Albuquerque demanded change to our police force. Of course, it was part of the Black Lives Matter movement, but it was also very specific to here because we have this long history of excessive use of force, according to the Department of Justice.
That's Marisa DeMarco, editor-in-chief of Source NM, a nonprofit newsroom in Albuquerque, New Mexico. So, Anthony, what's your take on how the issue of policing played out in so many municipal elections this year?
Yeah, it's really interesting. I mean, I was really struck by John Collins in Minneapolis. So this is the city that was at the epicenter of the protests against police violence post-George Floyd. And you know, they voted this measure down to defund the police. And in cities where crime was front and center, calls to defund the police lost. Not just Minneapolis, thinking of Seattle, which we'll talk about. Atlanta will choose between two police-friendly candidates in a runoff. And what's interesting to me, to come back to Boston and the race that I covered really closely, Anissa Saibi-George, who ran against Michelle Wu, you know, said again and again, I'm not for defunding the police. But the thing is, Michelle Wu never really said, I'm for defunding the police either. She spoke, she talked a lot more subtly about a kind of soft defunding, if you will, about reallocating resources. But really, her message was about police accountability. And her message was about high rents, housing, climate change, you know, and addressing historic inequality. So that message about defunding the police was really never front and center. But in cities where it was, it seems like most of the progressives lost.
Right. And I mean, to underscore your point, Anthony, as John was telling us, it was on the ballot, literally, physically, in Minneapolis. And that probably was a really influential factor here. Okay, well, you mentioned Seattle Well, it looks like Bruce Harrell will be the city's next mayor. And here he is talking with King 5 News on election night this week about his promises to, quote, clean up some major homeless encampments in Seattle by January or February of next year.
We're going to be very aggressive. I have to inventory exactly what the city has in terms of their resources. They're going through the budget now. So we will be aggressive about moving people out of parks and out of playgrounds, into housing. We're going to publish the plan. Everything that I said on the campaign trail, I will be accountable for. So, yes, absolutely.
Well, joining us now from Seattle is David Hyde, reporter at KUOW there. Hi there, David.
Hi, Meghna.
So tell us a little bit about the newly elected mayor of Seattle and what the race there says about what's happening in the city right now.
I should just clarify, it looks like Harrell's going to win. He's way ahead by something like 28 percentage points, but not all of the ballots have been counted yet. Mm. Our ballots here just have to be postmarked by Election Day, and technically nobody's conceded the race, but it sure looks like he's going to be the winner. And, you know, as you mentioned there, he ran as the more moderate left of center candidate on a lot of the big issues here, homelessness at the top, as well as policing and public safety, against the current Seattle City Council president, Lorena Gonzalez.
So tell us more about Lorena Gonzalez then. I mean, what were really the things that differentiated her significantly from Harrell?
You know, on homelessness in particular, they both announced plans to spend more money on stuff like housing and services to help homeless people. The biggest difference, as you had in your cut there, was over the issue of tent encampments. Lorena Gonzalez was pretty clear in telling voters that she would not sweep homeless people, not further victimize, vulnerable residents by moving them from place to place, in contrast with Harrell, who you heard there said that he would. And, you know, there were other big contrasts over public safety and policing.
Okay, so in terms of how the messaging played out amongst voters there, because let's stick with the homelessness issue because it's so, so important in Seattle right now. Was it that voters didn't like Gonzalez's approach, or that somehow just she didn't connect with them in terms of how she talked about how she'd handle homelessness?
You know, like the other deep blue cities that you're talking about today, Seattle residents see themselves as really progressive folks, right, who want to help homeless people. And both candidates, had those same messages in a sense. Harrell was announcing, big spending plan, a whole bunch of money for homelessness, for emergency housing and that sort of thing. Gonzalez had a similar kind of approach, talking about spending more money. One of the differences was, I think she emphasized taxes on big business, notably Amazon, and how she'd be raising taxes to kind of do that. But for whatever reason, I think voters felt like some of these public spaces, parks where there were children's spray parks or, say, behind schools, were incompatible with tent encampments, and voters picked Harrell.
Mm. Tell us a little bit more then about Bruce Harrell himself. Who is he? Where did he come from? A little bit about his political background.
Yeah, Harrell grew up in the central area of Seattle, the redlined central area, as he put it in his campaign ads. His father was black, originally from the Jim Crow South. His mom was Japanese American, interned during World War II. He emphasized and kind of linked that biographical story to his record as a city council member, serving on the city council and working on things like police reform. Body cams on cops was one of his issues back when he was on the council. He worked originally as a corporate lawyer, but also worked at some point as a civil rights attorney, as did his opponent, Lorena Gonzalez. And so on a lot of those biographical issues, they had a lot in common.
Huh. And how different is Harrell then from, let's say, the legacy established by now outgoing Mayor Jenny Durkan in Seattle?
You know, I would say he's a little bit to the left of Durkan, but they're both kind of, those business-friendly Obama-Biden-style Democrats, which for Seattle is kind of the far right. It ranges here from Obama kind of Biden Democrats all the way over to we have a Trotskyist on the city council.
Well, so one more question then for you, David, that I also asked John, and I'm going to ask all of our regional reporters here. So, for listeners in the rest of the country, what do you think they should draw as the lessons from the Seattle elections?
Well, we didn't talk much about it, but Lorena had talked about defunding police. The council last year defunded the Seattle police budget by around 20%, indicated that she was open to cuts of 50% or more. Not an abolitionist, but kind of abolitionist adjacent, and always linking those cuts to alternatives to traditional policing, unarmed responses, programs to address the root causes of crime. But for whatever reason, we've lost 300 cops here in the last year and a half. crime is up, 911 response times are up. And so Harold's message of saying, you know, actually, you know, I want police reform, but I'm going to hire a few more cops, seemed to resonate more this year with Seattle voters, assuming they voted on the issues.
Okay. I just have 30 more seconds with you, David, and I should have asked, I mean, because we're talking so much about policing, the city attorney's race was also quite interesting.
Yeah, we had a city attorney race with one candidate who was is an abolitionist who said that she would not prosecute many minor misdemeanors or really very many at all, versus her opponent, who's actually a Republican, and it looks like her Republican opponent may well win. And if that's the case, it would be the first Republican Seattle's elected since the 1980s.
So, but because you still have all those ballots coming in, we don't yet know the outcome of that race.
No, but it's looking very likely that the three more moderate, less progressive candidates are going to win.
Okay. David Hyde, reporter at KUOW in Seattle. Thank you so much, David.
Thanks, Magda.
All right, Anthony Brooks, hang on here for just a second. We'll pick up with a few more cities and, again, the big national takeaways when we come back. This is On Point.
A gruesome scandal at the nation's most prestigious university shines a light on a macabre and lucrative world of buying and selling human remains.
Human body parts taken by a manager at the Harvard Medical School morgue and then sold to customers online.
So my first skull is right there on the top shelf. That's my first and my favorite.
I'm reporter Allie Jarmani, and this story raises some tough questions. How should we treat the dead? And who gets to decide?
There should be some middle ground where we treat deceased tissues differently than we treat old refrigerators.
This is Postmortem, The Stolen Bodies of Harvard, a new season of WBUR's Last Scene. Listen and follow Last Scene wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and just want to give you a heads up about tomorrow's show. We're going to go to the port of Long Beach, California, and really try to get an on-the-ground understanding of what's happening with the massive backlog of container ships and cargo that's the choke point in America's supply chain right now. So if you work at the port of Long Beach, or if you have a family member or a friend who works there in any capacity, cargo, trucking, longshoremen, maybe on a ship, maybe a pilot, call us. We want to know what your experiences are at the Port of Long Beach every day. What are you seeing on the ground that we here in the rest of the country don't fully understand? We're at 617-353-0683. That's 617-353-0683. Looking at a day in the life of the port of Long Beach, California tomorrow. Today, we're talking about municipal races, mayoral races, district attorney races, city council races across the country, and what they might tell us about the mood of the national electorate as we all look forward towards 2022. And I'm joined by Anthony Brooks. He's senior political correspondent at WBUR. And Anthony, if you can listen along with me a little bit more, let's go straight to Atlanta, Georgia, and talk about the mayor's race there. Felicia Moore, one of the candidates, spoke to supporters after finding out the race will go into a runoff. She'll face Atlanta City Councilman Andre Dickens in the runoff on November 30th. But here's more this week.
Now, you all have heard that saying, by Felicia. Well, if you believe that Atlanta needs experienced, ethical, transparent, and accountable leadership, I want you all to join me and join this campaign by saying, hi, Felicia. Thank you.
Well, joining us now from Atlanta is Rose Scott, host of Closer Look with Rose Scott on WABE. It's great to have you back, Rose.
Same here. Thank you for having me.
Okay, so I'm seeing that the Atlanta mayoral race is being framed as this a fight for the future of Black political power in Atlanta. Does that sound right to you or not?
I'm going to say no.
Okay.
I don't think that that's fair. Listen, Atlanta has had a Black mayor since Maynard Jackson. This is back in 1970-something, whatever it was. Atlanta right now is changing. You know, the latest census indicates Atlanta's, for the first time in a long time, just under 50% in terms of the black population. And that points to a more diverse Atlanta. And there's nothing wrong with that by any means. For some folks, having a black mayor is important. But I think both candidates will tell you that at this point, it's about, at least through their lens, it's about having the best leadership.
So tell me more then about the candidates and about the fact that it's going to a runoff.
Well, I think also it's important to note that all the polling, which anyone that listens to my show understands that I'm not a big fan of polling because sometimes it usually gets it wrong. All the polling indicated it would be Felicia Moore, current Atlanta City Council president, and former Mayor Kasim Reed. Reed made a huge rock star type announcement when he was running for that he was coming back. He raised a ton of money. He was very adamant and confident the other night when we spoke to him during our election special that Andre Dickens would not beat him. He said it at least two or three times. And then what happens? Now Andre Dickens, fellow councilman, is in the runoff. So Andre Dickens, a native of Atlanta, grew up here, went to Atlanta Public Schools, went to Georgia Tech. Felicia Moore, not a native, but has lived here for at least three decades, has 20 years on city council before becoming city council president. So they are both familiar with city government. Their campaigns will probably, in these next few weeks, will probably mirror each other in terms of who can do what for this city.
And so what then are they promising? What are the major issues that have driven the campaigns?
I think like a lot of cities, Meghna, it's public safety, number one. Mm-hmm. That's been huge. Obviously, Atlanta's had a tremendous increase in violence and gun violence. Affordable housing, which, of course, you talked about Seattle. They are very familiar with that. Affordability, the homelessness population, our unsheltered population. You know, and all those quality of life sectors that impact Atlantans. And understand this, too, Atlanta, for the last few years, and still may be up there, has the highest income inequality gap in the nation. When Maynard Jackson decades ago said, you know, this is a city of haves and have-nots, and he wanted to bridge the folks on this side of the track with the folks on this side of the track, that still exists today.
Mm.
And so their campaigns will focus on that, all of those tentacles.
So can you tell us a little bit more about the moment that Atlanta finds itself in? Because I'm just remembering now that back in May, right, where Mayor Keisha Lance Bottoms made essentially what, you know, for a lot of us outside of Atlanta felt like a surprise announcement that she wasn't going to run again. But the last couple of months of her that period of time for her as mayor was quite rocky, wasn't it?
Well, you know, listen, in Atlanta, when you're the mayor, it was an understanding, it was a given that you will seek a second term. I spent a complete day with her, riding around, going to her old neighborhood, talking about her decision as to why she was not going to seek reelection. And she told me, she said even in the first year, she started to have doubts. Now, whether or not people believe that, you know, that's up to them. But through her lens, this was seeking another term was not in her favor.
Mm-hmm.
Atlanta is a city that is built on its identity that stems from the civil rights movement, and that is great. But Atlanta, we talked about this the other day with a political strategist, Atlanta is this city that has these sort of intervals of different identities and is still growing and still developing as to what will be the identity of the city.
Yeah.
We know about the civil rights movement. We know about the Olympic years. Our Braves just won the World Series, so we know about that. But Atlanta is a city that is becoming more and more diverse. And again, that's a good thing. But it, like other major cities, it is struggling with those quality of life issues that folks need assistance
mm-hmm.
with. Public housing,
mm-hmm.
you know, housing.
Yeah,
it's like any other city throughout the nation.
Well, yeah, and so given that, what do you think Atlanta? What's happening in Atlanta? Because the race isn't finished. It obviously it's going to that runoff. But what does that have to say about what might happen, you think, in 2022?
I think it is a toss-up. Folks could say, you know, well, let's look at Atlanta in terms of will folks – Atlanta typically has been a Democratic sector, and that's fine. Folks, we've been used to that. But Georgia as a whole has become more diverse. I think you're going to start to see the Democrats and Republicans really strategize in terms of 2022, how they look at this election in terms of, okay, do the Republicans, typically they don't focus on Atlanta and the surrounding counties in terms of trying to secure those votes. It's usually outside of Atlanta. It's usually the rest of Georgia. But I think that when you look at how diverse this population is becoming, I think you might start to see Republicans try to sway some of those suburban areas outside of Atlanta. I think we're seeing that in Virginia, right? Mm-hmm. So that's going to be very interesting to watch.
Yeah. Rose Scott, host of Closer Look with Rose Scott on WABE with us from Atlanta. It's so great to have you back on, Rose. Thank you.
Thank you, Meghna.
All right, Anthony, tell us what you hear we've talked about Seattle and about Atlanta as well.
Yeah, well, I was really struck by what Rose was talking about just in terms of what this portends for 2022. And I was reading a quote by Senator Elizabeth Warren, who told Politico that America's agenda is a progressive agenda. Now, she was talking about that as she campaigned with Michelle Wu here in Boston. She said, people across this nation want to see us move in a direction where the country works better for everyone, and that's what we're seeing in cities. So that's an interesting statement, obviously, by a political partisan. I'm not sure that Warren is right about that, because what happens in the heart of cities like Atlanta or even Boston this week isn't necessarily reflected just outside the cities. I mean, Meghna, as you know, that's even true here in Massachusetts. Massachusetts is a much more purple state than it's often given credit for. I mean, this is a state where a million folks voted for Donald Trump. Yes, it's a blue state. Yes, Boston is the bluest of blue cities. But I'm not sure that the sort of urban agenda necessarily reflects what folks are thinking outside of cities. And I think that, as we saw in Virginia, is going to be one of the big questions, sort of what happens outside the cities, in the suburbs. I think that's going to be one of the big questions going toward 2022.
I think that's exactly right, Anthony, which is why we're framing this hour as what's happening in metropolitan regions, right? Because it's not just the urban core, but the suburbs that ring those urban cores that make up that 80% of the U.S. population. That's exactly right. So, for example, in Florida, Hialeah is a city in Miami-Dade County in South Florida. 90% of the residents there are Hispanic. It's home to a higher percentage of Cuban and Cuban Americans than any city in the United States. And in Hialeah, the mayoral winner was Esteban Steve Bovo. He was actually called on to run by Florida's Republican Governor Ron DeSantis. He was also endorsed by former President Trump. And Trump wrote, quote, Steve, like so many families in Hialeah, knows how socialism destroys a country from within, end quote. Now, Luis Hernandez is with WLRN, and he says Hialeah is going to be key if Republicans want to make South Florida reliably red.
Hialeah is key. Like, if you want to set a foothold in South Florida and start building a base, Hialeah is where you're going to do it. And Hialeah was a huge Trump encampment. It really was. So to have that guy win, I think says a lot about the strategy for the governor's race next year. And then, you know, for 2024, whoever's going to be running, if it's going to be Trump or DeSantis, if you want to try to steal some of the blue away from South Florida, it's going to start in Hialeah.
And that is what happened this week in the mayoral race there in Hialeah, a city in Miami-Dade County. Now let's go up the coast to Buffalo, New York, where Democratic Socialist India Walton was the Democratic nominee there. She had a surprise win against Byron Brown earlier in the primary, the mayoral primary. But Brown mounted a major write-in and clinched the win on Tuesday night. So he was asked by a reporter with WGRZ-TV if he'd be willing to work with Walton's younger, more progressive supporters.
We have been listening all along. We are open to working with people, listening to people, but people also need to participate in the community in ways that lend themselves to people being able to work with them. You can't not show up to anything in the community, throw bricks on the outside, and expect the people to listen to you in that fashion. So if people really want to work together, we are here to work with them, to listen to them, but listening and working together is a two-way street.
Well, joining us now from Buffalo is Dave Debo. He's news director at WBFO. Hello there, Dave.
Glad to be with you.
So what happened in Buffalo this week?
A couple things happened, I think. In the primary, where India Walton became the Democratic nominee, the endorsed Democrat, the incumbent mayor just thought, oh, she's a Democratic socialist. I don't really have to campaign. He didn't engage in any debates. He didn't do a lot of outreach. And she was able to win because he didn't show up, more or less. Then in the general election, even though he was a write-in candidate, he definitely showed up. I think he did a tremendous job of making the race about her status as a Democratic socialist. In the soundbite you just played a moment ago, there was kind of a flavor of that, the idea that she's this outsider trying to destroy the institutions, throwing bricks. That was really, I think, the issue in the entire race. And then the other part of it was not only did he just show up, but he had an organization that was able to do a lot of things that she, as a relative newcomer, just didn't.
Well, so that was the issue in the entire race, as you're saying, as now Mayor Brown categorized it. I mean, was it, from the point of view of voters, a rebuff of the rise of interest in democratic socialism that was evidenced by India Walton's supporters?
To some degree, it was. I think it was more a rebuff of her because of the way he was able to brand her. He also was making a case, obviously, after 15 and a half years in office, that as the incumbent, he was the steady hand on the tiller. He was the one who knew how to get things done for the sake of downtown and economic development. The business community certainly played a role in helping him in that regard. So I think it was not so much a rejection of any individual issue that could go under the banner of democratic socialism, but it was more a, oh, my God, are we going to elect a democratic socialist? He made the issue about her. She was talking about poverty. She was talking about police. She was talking about a lot of those issues. But it kind of got wrapped up in one big bow that said, in the end, steady hand incumbent or outside newcomer.
Interesting. Okay. Well, Dave Debo, news director at WBFO in Buffalo, thank you for being so patient. And thank you for sharing with us what happened there in Buffalo, New York.
Glad to do it.
Okay, Anthony, we've just got a minute and a half left here. I think the threads and the themes are pretty self-evident across this hour. So if you are a strategist in the Republican or Democratic parties, what do you think the lessons that they're taking from these mayoral, these municipal races are that, you know, that we might see applied next year in the midterms?
Yeah, it's really interesting. I mean, again, I come back to this idea where in cities where crime was front and center, calls to defund the police lost. And that seems to be a really, really potent issue that progressives have a hard time running against. On the other hand, in cities like Boston or cities like Cleveland that both elected progressive mayors, Pittsburgh and Kansas City each elected its first black mayor. And we heard Dearborn, Michigan elected an Arab American Muslim. So when the theme can be inclusion, when the theme can be addressing sort of generations of inequality, when that message gets through, then I think Democrats can do very well. And I think that's one of the messages that comes out of some of these cities, not all of them, but some of them.
Mm. Well, Anthony Brooks, senior political correspondent at our home station, WBUR, and of course, frequent On Point fill-in host as well. It's always great to talk with you, Anthony. Thank you so very much.
Hey, Meghna, it was my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.